to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour and on irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Center for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned center for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. I hope, folks, that February is getting off to a good start for you and that this cold weather isn't putting in too much on you. Here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, we are busying ourselves with the second week of the semester with our graduate and undergraduate classes, and we're really looking forward to kicking off our public events programming in terms of our normal Thursday night events next Thursday, February 12th at 7 p.m. We are delighted to have Cullum Tobin, the acclaimed Irish writer, reading from his best-selling novel, Nora Webster, which is the story of a newly widowed mother struggling to recover until she begins to sing again. The New York Times Book Review has called it beautiful and daring. And I am very excited because Cullum has kindly agreed to come in and have a chat to me. So we will be having a chat with Cullum on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour next week. So I hope that you can tune into it if you aren't able to make the event on Thursday night. I believe we're at capacity in terms of our RSVPs for Cullum's event. There may be room on the waitlist if any of you are still interested in attending. Shoot us an email at ireland.house@nyu.edu. Now, we're also coming into a very important period for us as we approach the priority deadline for applying to the Masters of Arts in Irish and Irish American Studies here at Glucksman Ireland House, NYU. March 1st is our priority deadline, although we will accept rolling admissions. So we do suggest if you are thinking of applying to consider March 1st as a date to work towards, and we will begin reviewing applications to the program after that date. If you're interested in finding out more about our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies, I just want to let you know that we have an open house coming up next Friday, February 13th from 5 to 7 p.m. You'll have an opportunity to sit down and meet some of our faculty members, some of our alumni, and some of our current students, and hear about the program, including the generous scholarships that we have currently on offer. So mark that date in your diaries, folks, Friday, February 13th. Hopefully it'll be a lucky day for you rather than unlucky Friday the 13th. If you would like to find out more about this, just send us an email again to ireland.house@nyu.edu. But it is an open house forum, so just pop in any time between 5 and 7 p.m. Later that evening, we're delighted to have another Blarney Star concert. The Dublin-born New Yorker Ivan Goff, who also teaches for us here at Glucksman Ireland House, he's a member of our faculty team. He's a master of the Illan pipes and the flute. And at 8 p.m. on Friday the 13th, as part of this concert, he will be playing with fiddler Cleek Sheary, who will join in a lovely compliment to Ivan's mastery on the pipes and flute. Cleek's fiddle playing and his Norwegian violin will be a lovely compliment to Ivan. So that promises to be a great night at 8 p.m. here at Glucksman Ireland House. So they are the events that are kind of on top of us. I just wanted to remind you as to what's coming up, as we always take the opportunity to do here on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. And as we progress through the month and the semester, of course, I'll be updating you as to what's on every week. On February the 19th, just so you have it on your radar, we're delighted to have Professor Maureen Murphy of Hofstra University. She'll be here to launch her new biography on A. Smith Nicholson, who was a very interesting individual who travelled through Ireland and wrote about Ireland during the famine. And I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. So that's on February the 19th at 7 p.m. here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU. I believe we do still have space at that event. So if you are interested in becoming a member or RSVPing for that event, if you are a member, just shoot us an email to ireland.house@nyu.edu. So in terms of other noteworthy events in the New York area, I did also want to draw your attention again, Midwinter Fest, new works for chamber orchestra by composers from Ireland and the US, which will take place on Sunday, February 15th at 3 p.m. at Christ and St. Stephen's Church at 120 West 69th Street. That's between Broadway and Columbus. It's free admission. If you want to find out more about this, go to www.northsouthmusic.org. The renowned composer Frank Corcoran, an Irishman by way of Germany, will be here as part of that celebration, and he's one among a few others who will be playing that night at the Christ and St. Stephen's Church. So hopefully we'll have Frank Corcoran here to have a chat to us on next week's show, because he's passing through town and we'd like to hear a little bit more about his work and his composing and this celebration of the Irish and American composers. On this week's show, folks, I wanted to share with you the audio of an event which is now even more special, and in a moment you'll understand why I say that. In the fall of 2012, we had the pleasure of welcoming renowned writer Dermot Healy from Ireland, and he was here to talk about his new novel at the time, Long Time No See, which received rapturous acclaim, set in the isolated coastal town of Ballintra in northwest Ireland, and it centres around a cast of innocents and wounded and broken misfits. Dermot was born in Westmeath in Ireland in 1947 and was a playwright and poet, and unfortunately in June of 2014 he passed away all too soon. He was the author of three novels, a memoir, a collection of stories, and five volumes of poetry. His prizes included the Hennessy Award for Short Stories, the Tom Gallen Award, and the Encore Award. And he was also winner of the 2002 America-Ireland Literary Award, which was funded by the American-Ireland Fund and is given in recognition of his contribution to Irish letters. It was a lovely event, as so many are, at One Washington Mews, here where we are today. And he was introduced by my friend and colleague, Professor John Waters, who's clinical professor of Irish studies here and director of graduate studies. Dermot lived in Sligo, and John Waters himself has deep connections with County Sligo. And he gave a lovely introduction to Dermot, and it was lovely to hear Dermot read from this new book. Little did we know that it would be the last time that we would have him visit us here at One Washington Mews. So I thought it would be a nice opportunity for any of you who were not present at that event to have the opportunity to hear the late, great Dermot Healy read from his novel, Long Time No See. Sit back for the next 40 minutes or so, folks, and you can imagine yourself sitting here at One Washington Mews, hearing and watching Dermot Healy read from this book.
You've already heard me talk about this book, because each of the last several times that I've introduced a speaker at Ireland House over the last 6 weeks, I've said I'm reading this book, and I've told you to come. And I see a lot of you who are here because I've told you to come. That's because this is a special book for me in a lot of ways. I mentioned last week when Pete Hamill was here that I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up on East 27th Street and Avenue M. And I'm the seventh of eight kids, and we were in a three-bedroom house. So as the youngest boy, I was the one who, when I came home from college, I'd sleep on the couch. And the couch was out in a porch, three windows around the side, but the house that we were renting had bookshelves built into all the walls. And at some point, I came home from school, and I'd always just go around the bookshelves and see what was there. And then there was this book that appeared, The Bend for Home. And I opened it up, and I don't know when I stopped reading it. It was sometime early in the morning, you know, over Christmas vacation. And it was around the time in college when I was trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do after college. And I decided that I would apply to go to school in Ireland. And I won't say that that was it or was part of it, but it was a part of a constellation of books. I'd been introduced to a number of Irish poets before then who captured my head. But I don't know which of my brothers and sisters got that book or where the hell they got it from, but they put it on the shelf there for me to find. And I'd read a few other things by Dermot Healy in the intervening years. I'd read The Reed Bed, which I discovered, I think, I want to say, in Hodges Figures in Dublin when I was back on a visit at some point in time. But to my shame, I didn't know that Dermot was in Sligo, where my family are. And I didn't have the wherewithal then to appreciate that I was going to come in contact with an artist from living in Sligo, writing about Sligo, capturing Sligo. That's the thing that I want to get to in saying a few prefatory words about this book. I didn't have an appreciation then that where I was going when I was going to school and every trip back, going to visit home, going to visit family, traveling around the back of beyond, seeing people, I didn't have a sense that I was going to get caught up the way I am now in a book that was just going to get the place, get the ear, get the rhythm, get the light, and then get the weird, weird angles at which people live and come together in a place. So when Kieran Carson was here for the O'Malley, for the Quinlan lecture, a little over a month ago, and I told him I was reading this book, and I just said, Kieran, he's an old and close friend, and we were out to dinner, and I just said, Kieran, I'm in the grip of an incredible book. And I told him what it is, and all he did was he grabbed my arm, and he said, that's the real stuff. I've been thinking about this book and where it's set. I won't speak too much about it because I don't know it in the way that the man himself, who will speak in a minute, knows it. But when I think about what's happened in Ireland and the way that Ireland has been shook and changed and diverted from itself, bewildered a bit, what does it know of itself, what happened, etc. And I just have such joy that a work of literature can do for the country what this book did and does. It's a very powerful thing to to wonder about so much of what has transformed a place that continues to give the gifts of culture and literature out to the world. And then you think it's bewildered, and then Jesus, you find a book like this, it's like, no, it's not. It's still settled, still. The ear is there, the eye is there. The rhythms of speech in this book are just phenomenal. I won't go into the superlatives for it. You can tell from the way I'm speaking about it. You're all used to listening to me introduce things. I don't talk about books the way I talk about this book. It may be that the Sligo personal connection for me, that I think so much about the conversation that this book captures. So I just want to say a few things to you before you hear Dermot Healy read from this book. There's more humor and generosity of spirit in this book than I can think of. I don't know when I last read anything quite like it. it's a book about somebody who just did the leave insert. And I wrote a paper one time about The Dark by John McCaughan. This is the light. This is the light on the other side of the dark, really. It's a book that observes how people live and how people maintain their curious sense of connection. Most importantly, connection across generations. This is a book that has great young people in it and great old people in it. And great young people and great old people chatting away, figuring out a little bit of crack out of nothing. There are passages, I won't read them, but Jesus God, my daughter makes bookmarks for me for each book I read. I ask her to. And, you know, this is her long time no see bookmark. And, you know, when you start writing on the insides of them and sort of. I stopped after page 60 because I just couldn't keep up. There's so many passages that I think, Jesus, how did he get that down? The way he got it down, I think, I'm not sure. I just met Dermot just a bit ago. It's patience, it's witness, all sorts of love and dedication. I don't know much about that in how it comes through from Dermot Healy, but we welcome a lot of books into the house at Ireland House. This is a great book. We're lucky that Dermot Healy's here to read from it. So please join me in welcoming him.
Thanks, John. Will I smile?
Picture, yes.
I've lived in Sligo for the last about 20 years. I didn't know that both my mother's father and my father's father had come from that direction. Didn't know it. Returned from England via Belfast and just ended up there. Am I talking too fast? Okay. And a lot of it was, the book is based on sometimes that whole thing of there was neighbours that I met. There was a lot of spinsters, a lot of unmarried men, funny enough, by the sea. And they spent their own time together. And sometimes I'd call and they'd have these conversations which were not the conversations I would have known. And sometimes it might be based on humour, but sometimes it was based on another thing. I won't put the name on it. There was young fellas in my past that had helped out old people and young girls. You know, went to the houses, went to the shop, collected stuff. And that would have been the basis of a lot of the story. But they would do it out of their own, you know, wish, not because of any social thing. And then there was the thing of people coming in from abroad that were living in the area, or might come out and fish and do things. And it was funny living by the sea. I'd worked on a fishing boat for years, but now I was living by the sea. And for the first time, it sounded like as if one of them big, huge trucks were coming in, and what it was the high tide. I'd lived in Ross's Point for a number of years and would have had to put out where we are now. A whole lot of different presentations came. And I suppose this is where the book started. It's about a man called Mr. Psyche, meaning an 18-year-old, 17-year-old, and they used to call him locally that, and it's never explained why. And why I don't explain it is because I leave it with the reader to understand, so the reader can make up their mind and tell who's talking. When I'm reading it, I'll put a little bit of voice over in it so you can tell the difference. But really what I was doing was just leave that dramatic listening in your own ear. The second man in it, Jojo is the first, who's his granduncle, Mr. Psyche's granduncle, and the second man is the Blackbird, who was called the Blackbird. And funny enough, Mr. Waters here has a namesake who is the Blackbird Waters. I know you don't understand what I mean. In Sligo, there's a man living, and his sister has a pub here in New York, and he's Waters, and he's known locally as the Blackbird. Now, this was no intention of mine when I was doing the book. but I just knew it was such a lovely term for someone. Here comes the blackboard. And so this is the young fella coming in to light the fire for his granduncle. I headed down to the townland of Ballantra in a force 8 to light the fire towards the beginning of August.
Ha ha,
said Jojo, opening the door a fraction. She's windy, I said. Oh, it's you, he said. It is Uncle Jojo. He was my granduncle, but sometimes I call him Granda.
Hold her. I have it. Right now. Okay. Okay, go. Tarish Jock, he shouted.
Because there's such a wind blowing, you have to watch the door. I took the handle and slid through with a couple of newspapers under my arm. He stepped back as I stepped in. The tablecloth rose. Timmy the dog done a turn, and I swung the door shut. Jojo studied me with his back against the shaking panels. I was expecting me dear neighbour, Mr. Blackbird. Sorry about that. And I said to myself, that's him. And it was me. It was you. But it was his knock. You see, a knock can carry anyone's signature on a day like that. I could have sworn. You know what it is, son? Memory is a stranger who comes to call less and less. And sometimes he's not welcome, if you know what I mean. Or he could be anyone, is that right? But not you. He turned the key, let down the latch, pulled back the curtain on the window and looked out. Is it the northwest? Meaning the wind. It is, the worst, but not as bad as February 9th in 87, he said as he came back from the misty, drenched table, window to the table. I don't like the look of it. The worst is at the filling in of the moon, he said, handing me the leather-handled knife, and then he put a plate of unboiled bacon before me. You're just in time. The bird will not stir that day, I'll warrant you. He'll stop above in his budgeons, that sorry old bed of his. I began to saw off some of the raw fat, and he threw the first slice to Timmy, the dog, who nursed it up against the bedroom door. Then Jojo brought the remainder of the bacon joint into the kitchen and set it into a pot of boiling water filled with parsley and chives. He put the small slices of fat onto a saucer on the middle shelf of the dresser, out of reach of Timmy, and alongside the wayward lad. That was a picture on the wall, or on the thing. They were for his rat trap that he would set last thing that night. Now he said, how is the farm, Mr. Psyche? Not so bad, Granda. Are you fit for dealing with a bad-tempered crater like me? I am. He stood back and looked at the dresser, then lifted down one of his prayer books and handed it me to read. Read, mister, he said, from the Psalms. The Bible he always called the Psalms. I picked a page at random, and as always it fell open at one of the texts where he turned down the corner of a page from past readings. And behold, I said, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. He was not, he said. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a small voice. Amen, he said quietly. We're in this together, Mr. Psyche. And this would be a thing he'd done because Jojo couldn't read or write, but he had the memory, and so he'd asked him to read it out. He'd picked up the book from a big house that he'd worked in, the Bible, and it became his memory joint. 25. We're now moving into a different territory where the blackbird has come down to the house, and they're drinking Drombuie, the two older men, and the young fella has to go and get it, go into the village, go into the pub and bring out the bottle of Drombuie. I went out to the shed for turf, and when I came in, the blackbird turned his troubled eyes on me. Just before you came in, he said, the room was full. Full of what? I asked. what he says, the ghosts of hens. Did you ever get that? Never, I said. Nor me, said my grand uncle. I saw no bucking hens. Well, they were here. Oh, more fucking madness. Well, let me see, the blackbird explained, sitting up. The rooster, he says, comes first cock-a-doodle-doodling and screeching with no sound. It's a terror to hear a sound that's not there. Have you ever heard a sound that's not there? No, I said. Well, you will in time. Definitely not a Jojo. And he rolls his eyes to heaven. Now, the blackbird explained, he, the rooster, stands over there, and he indicated the far corner of the room, on a bookstand that has no books. That's where the rooster stands, you know, cock-a-doodling, with his head back, and a run of blue temper from his bill to his head feathers. The comb on the top of his skull, all bristling, and dreadful black eyes, I can tell you. Cock-a-doodling! Say, cock-a-doodle. Cock-a-doodle. Say it louder. Cock-a-doodle! Cock-a-doodle! Very good, now you have it. Cock-a-doodle! And I can hear you, said the blackbird. That's right, but I can't hear him. Do you see? That's the problem. Oh, and there, over there, he stands raising one claw a little, just very slightly. And the blackbird stood and raised his right foot ever so quietly, just a fraction off the floor. Then he put it down, then he lifted it again, like the rooster then. And he held back his head and said to me, go, cock-a-doodle. Cock-a-doodle, said me and Jojo together. He straightened up, and then you know what happens. No, in come the ghost hens. Indeed they do, said Jojo, and it's something shocking. Oh, they come flocking from everywhere, said the blackbird, through the walls, the doors, the windows, the ceilings, the fireplace, and they're busy. Oh, they're very busy, said Jojo. And what did they start doing, sir? And the blackbird signaled my direction. Cock-a-doodling.
No.
So what did they do? They go, chukka-waka-waka-waka. Oh, right, said Jojo. The birds have changed their tune. Dead on. But they're not so loud as the rooster, when I think of it, but loud nevertheless. Then all these ghost hens start their chanting. A chanting you can't hear. Flocking around, raising their wings. Then the rooster jumps down out of his perch and starts chasing them round the room, and the hens go mad. Then what happens? Well, they're likely to land anywhere, on your head, anywhere to get away from him, and he chases them faster and faster, and then bang, one of them lands in me pocket. He clapped his pocket. Then another. He clapped his pocket. Then another. No. Yes. Oh, dear. And once this happens, the next hen jumps into me pocket. There is only the one left, just the one, and the rooster's left chasing the last hen round the room. And what does she do? She jumps into me pocket with a screech. And now there's no one but himself. And what does he do? He lets one last cock-a-doodle-doo-doo, said me granduncle. Aye, and bang, he goes into me pocket. And then what happens? You come into the room. And he wiped away a tear that was not there. Oh, and so I'm here, he said, and he pulled out the lining out of his pocket, shook it, pushed it back in, and here I'm left with a pocketful of ghost hens. I know it doesn't make sense, but oh yeah, one of the things that Psyche's doing to keep himself, which they're saying, is building a wall. I brought water to the sick cow who was lying in the meadow looking out to sea. Did three lawns at the mass, the teachers, the bankers and the Germans. Then I went to the wall at the back of the house. I was out there building stone for 3 hours. I'd been at this dry stone wall for 3 weeks, on and off, and it was good work. All you needed was a length of string, a few rocks, and a sense of balance. Sometimes I'd be building walls in my dreams. Some of the stones I used had come inland in storms, but today I started a haul from an old ruin up on the bank overlooking the sea. I got an awful bad feeling as I pulled the rocks out of the ruin. I had to tell myself over and over that we're going back into another wall. The ruin was supposed to be in a hen house way back, but it was the strongest built hen house I ever came across. There were massive stones in her. I could have been demolishing a small church, and sometimes I thought I was. A beehive hut, it might have been. A monk's chamber. I could even feel the sense of balance of the man who had built it. He drew the stone from the coral beach by ass and cart to the spot I was taking him from. As he built alongside me, I was pulling his work down. As he dropped the stone into place, I lifted it and carried it away. He built towards me and I built away from him. I could feel the way he carried himself. He could have been a great great grand uncle of mine. In his wall I came across chaffs of wheat that were still dry, the bones of coral, white marble, one clay pipe. I was over and back with the barrow, then I began to build, and he came with me. Fit in, stand back, put in a small stone, and follow the twine. Good man. He stood to the side watching me work. The light was going and coming, and there were sudden gusts of wind coming from the northwest. An empty bucket went flying across the field. A heave of salt flew across. Then up went a puff of sparks from the rusted transformer on the electric pole next to the house. The gust passed. The sky darkened. There was one faraway cackle of seagulls. The island drifted out of sight. Good evening, said my father. I got an awful shock to find him standing behind me, right where I placed the stone man. It's time to call a halt, he said. It's getting dark. I'm trying to take a weight off your shoulders, Philip. I put in a few more stones and stood against the wall, then sort of took cover, ducked low, and turned for the house. Psyche was also, his real name was Philip. I should have explained that at the beginning. All that Thursday and Friday afternoon, I worked the wall, pushing the wheelbarrow to and fro, lifting, looking, standing back, and then heading off again. I was trying to get the curve right. The curve had to be gradual. The thing to do was let each stone find its place. This was the rule that went through my head. Every time I lifted a rock, I heard a command from somewhere in the past. Let the rock find its own balance. Let it sit on its own weight. And when it does, only then push in the slanted stones to right the position. I have rules for everything. If the rock does not fit, wait. Every rock will find its place in the wall. No stone should be proud and stand out from the rest. It is a small stone that no one sees gives all the balance. I had nearly taken down half of that small monastery, stone by stone, and moved it an acre away to shield the garden that did not yet exist. All that was growing in there now was whins and nettles and thistles and wild grass. Da was on the lookout for topsoil. What I was doing, I was trying to repeat the pattern of the old stonework in the new wall. I lifted out a rock from the old shed, and there in an empty space I came across a child's shoe surrounded by chaffs of wheat. It was small, made of leather, and still unharmed. I brought it up and carefully placed it in the drawer in my room. I took the chaffs of wheat and found places for them in the new wall. The wall grew along the curve. A choir of starlings stood feeding on the seeds of the New Zealand flax that stood over my head in the next flower garden. Hello, I called. Hello, they called back. Then they began the flirty whistling. A stone chat flew by, spun by, then the wren with a tipped up tail hopped along a branch of Illyria, keeping time to a questioning song she sang alone. There was no reply. Then Timmy appeared, the dog, and started pulling himself to and fro against a low, tough, hanging branch of Illyria, all for a scratch on the back. I thought of the two sailors, Russians, heading up the road as I saw the Lithuanians make their way with the fishing rods along the beach. Then along came the Japanese fisherman who always parked his motorcycle in our drive. A year ago he'd asked for permission, and some days he'd arrive, shout a greeting, and drop out of sight behind the alt. The gulls were thrashing round Tingle's boat as it sped outside the bar. Beyond that, a trawler was heading towards the island. The thing was to lift, put in place, let sit, then gather, push, wait, while across from me the clothes that Ma had hung out that morning on the washing line blew like the front line of an army of empty ghosts. The sea thrift was losing its white leaves, the heads of the sea pinks had faded to grey. And later on, moving out of his world, the blackbird is in hospital, and which leads also to a moment when Jojo goes to hospital, but this is one particular little period. The blackbird is inside, and again, these are people who had never been in relationships. Wash your hands, said a voice over the speaker as we entered the doors. The blackbird was sitting in an armchair by his bed, with his cap on his head. The wrist of his left arm was still in a sling. He was gazing straight ahead of him with a quiet look. On the tray on the small bed was half a bowl of ice cream. On the table, the doujin sat. He brought in the doujin from the wall to give it to him. In the next bed along, the same man was doing his crossword puzzle. The male nurse was singing to a man who was feeding another bed. The bird saw these two people approaching him at the last minute. Long time no see, Jojo, he said, and he offered his right hand and struck hands. Mr. Psyche, he nodded. Sir, I said, shaking his hand, and for the first time in my life, I didn't get the faraway smell of mint and perfume from him. Instead, he smelt of sweat and soap. He used to use perfume all the time, and I'd always smell it from. How are you? Asked Jojo. I wiped away a tear before you came in, said the bird. It was my mother's. Oh, Christ. You see, I go into the past because they've denied me the present. There was a silence, but then his voice kicked in again. I'm still living in that crevice. I don't have a story, Jojo, because there is no story. I understand you. I can see everything out of the corner of my eye. I have a swollen gland in my brain. It's like a stitch of pain in the tooth. Now, tell me this. Go ahead. What is constipation? Well, tell us. A handbag full of waste. Steady. You see, I'm going to get better, but they won't let me home. And a whole lot of shit is piling up. I see, aye. The male nurse in a stiff white coat came over and leaned down and sang a couple of notes into the bird's ear as he wiped his face with a wet cloth. The last time I saw her, she was wearing a cloak and I was wearing a jumper, said the bird sadly. You were. And we took a waltz, you did. Then she wasn't there. Oh, lonesome is as lonesome does, said Jojo. She walked out through the door, she did, and never came back, no. I'd rather live without the other sex. But you do, not willingly. But you see, the truth is, I was always afraid of beautiful women. I could work either as a nun or a priest when I get out, if I get out. Touch wood, said Jojo, and he tapped the bedside locker. The dark-haired, broad-shouldered nurse sang to the bird, Dahil sayo, dahil sayo. What language is that? I asked. Tagalog, he said, and then he sang in English. Because of you, I want to live until the end of time. And just to finish with a small little piece. The young fellow had seen a coat hanging down at the pier, and it was there, and they didn't see, and a pair of shoes. I didn't understand if it was a signal or a sign or something like that. I said to Jojo, who had not stirred out of the house in 10 days, that I'd seen a coat hanging from a stake by the pier. Did you? I did. Now then, well, what? And who owned it? No one. Oh, very good, he said. But then I saw a pair of shoes down the strand. He looked at me roomy-eyed, he wet his lips. And no one about, no. And he nodded as if he understood. Not a soul, no. It's bad, he said. It's a bad sign. He stirred himself, took his coat off the back door, put it on, and sat. Suddenly he knocked the wood rest of the chair with his knuckles and looked at me as if he was demanding something. You're too young, he said bitterly. Too young for what? For the whole shebang. You know nothing. By the time you know, it'll be all over. Thanks a lot. Sorry for ending up on that sad note. I did that. I just picked it out at random.
When you heard Dermot read from that, if, like myself, you were flipping to the pages to watch, you came across a question to yourself, which is, Joyce introduced these dashes to introduce quotes, and Dermot uses some dashes to introduce quotes, but then there's dialogue that has no dash, no quote, quotation marks, barbaric items. They're banished from this book, it seems. But there's a question now. When it's a great advantage that everybody in this room has, that you've heard the book from the author's voice, and so you know the voicing that moves in and out of what's preceded by a dash and what isn't. But I was going to say, Dermot, the punctuation and the way in which you manage the voice in and out of people's heads, and then what we have to discern is in a head or is in actual voicing, right? Could you say something about that, about how you think through the way that voices interact in your writing as you do it? How you indicate, because hearing you, I think everybody here, if they were reading along, they can see the dialogue. But I wonder, I think in America especially, some people may have to go on a learning curve to get there, to understand how you're putting conversation down on a page. I know that we learn as we go along in the book and we get it, I think. But I wonder now about what you might say about that aspect of your writing and your dialogue and the scenes that you set.
Well, it took over in the last few years, and a couple of times when I had to do film scripts, I put in too much dialogue for them, the directors. It just took over, and I think what it is, you know, the things you overhear. You know, you overhear, besides what you're saying yourself, and sometimes overhearing. You don't know the people, but you hear two voices, maybe three voices. I kept hearing it here in New York over the last day and a half. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and absolutely. So it's sometimes overhearing, and I wanted to get that thing off the kid, you know, the young fella, overhearing, even though he's answering back, and to get that, and to leave it up to the reader to follow the voices. But in actual fact, you have Emma Leonard does it in his thrillers, and they go right the way through. You know who's speaking. Do you know what I mean? And this one here, I wouldn't have it direct, because there was a few people said to me they didn't quite know. They weren't too sure. They had to go back over it to find that. But when I was reading out the JoJo part this evening, I worked on it for I don't know how long, just to get the right tone on the page. so that you knew who it was. But it was kind of difficult. But I didn't want to put in, one of the things someone said one time was that if you say I love you, he said softly, it doesn't sound like I love you. If you say I love you, fine. So in other words, it has to fit into the room. Because if you put in an advertisement, you know, an adjective, what you're doing is actually trying to sell it. And so it kind of came from reading quite a lot of writers over the years, to find that your mind, your imagination could go in and actually lift it up and take it out. Ah, that's what's going on. I would have gone back into Marquez and things like that for learns, where you just, I hate you, she said softly.
Felt as if you were placing words the way the psyche was placing stones on the wall. Was that a conscious metaphor?
I wasn't conscious at the time, but I think you're quite right. I might have been doing that, when he was doing it. That's the only time he has an interior life, when he's doing it. The other time he's just a witness and listening. I had dream sequences and things like that, and I took them out. And I think that's it. That's what he's at interior-wise. And that's why I probably chose the pieces to read. I can't be too sure. It was really to take out the interior life, so you didn't have, I felt sad, I felt bad, I felt good, or I couldn't stand them, to lift all that out. So it's not got any of them motivations. But what it might be is he's learning from the old men, without it being said.
Can you talk a little bit about drywall building, and explain what drywall building of?
Sure. Well, one of the things there is, you know, you have the lads on the outside, you lift them up, but behind it, you're putting in the small ones all the time, the wee fractions that hold it up, and no one ever sees them. They own the Galway walls, the round ones that go up. Sometimes people think of the walls as square ones, but the round ones go up. And it was because I had to do a huge job one time building walls and learn from it. Not that I'm a good wall builder, but I learned from it a little bit how the unseen, and they'd be psychologically, it'd be correct, the unseen little stone wall that holds it up is not known, is not there. And so you might use a bit of gravel, okay, to hold it, but generally no, to let the wind whistle through.
Is it true that the stones are placed so that the cattle can look through the wall?
That was the old one in Galway. Yeah, they used the round ones and left the space,
yes,
so they could look through, so they didn't get lonely.
Yeah, cattle are always wanting to go to the place next door, the field next door. I guess the grass is greener there, but once their curiosity is satisfied, when they look through, they have no desire to go then. So it's a way of keeping them in.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it took me, that was all things I learned. But a lot of the stuff that's in this comes from old people that told me the story. We're nearly finished on it. I just read a wee poem. I know it off by heart. This is a book I brought out just last year as well, or the year before. Storms are promised that never come, and storms not promised that do. They come out of the blue, out of the blue, because they're true. Oh, they're true to their word, the storms not promised, and they wreck you, they wreck you, they do. Okay, thank you.
I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the Irish and Irish American Studies Master's Program at NYU. Ireland is an extraordinary object of study in the contemporary humanities and social sciences. It's a small country on a global scale, a small population with an incredible cultural impact. Our MA program is an interdisciplinary MA program and a transdisciplinary MA program. We're able to work with students who come to study Irish literature, to study Irish history, to study Irish music, to study Irish culture. All of them find a really dynamic home for their passions and their interests here at Glucksman Ireland House.
we approach the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies in a way that attempts to kind of break down disciplinary boundaries that sometimes impede the ability to really get a rounded understanding of a culture or of a history or of a society.
It incorporates almost every single part of Irish culture that you can get. It's not just Irish history. It's not just Irish literature or language or culture or music. It's a little bit of everything.
New York is actually an excellent place to pursue Irish studies. A steady stream of visitors is constantly arriving in New York from Ireland, and so we're able to capitalize on a really vital stream of Irish culture that continues to renew the presence of Irish cultural life in New York City. We're based in a landmark building on Washington Mews, which is a picturesque, quaint street at the very bottom of Fifth Avenue, right across the street from the Washington Square Arch. So we're in a very dynamic physical location, but we're also host to a dynamic internal energy.
The Irish experience is actually a key part of understanding the ethnic experience of New York City and the growth of the city and the development of the city into what it is today.
We're committed to the idea that a very large part of Irish historical experience has taken place outside of Ireland. We think we've actually fashioned a lens for the study of the Irish experience here in New York that really wouldn't be available anyplace else in the world.
The Glessman Ireland House is at the center of New York City, which is the center of Irish and Irish American studies, period.
This is where novelists, poets, essayists, historians, sociologists, anthropologists, this is where they want to come to launch their work in New York.
We have welcomed people like current President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, former President Mary Robinson, Bono.
Recently, Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney came and spoke very eloquently about how he sees the contribution of Ireland House to Irish cultural life. If James Joyce were alive and wanted to launch a new book in the United States, Glessman Ireland House at NYU is where he would launch it.
NYU offers a summer in Dublin program whereby students travel and spend 6 weeks at Trinity College in Dublin, the oldest university in Ireland.
I studied abroad at Trinity through the NYU Glessman Ireland House last summer. It really connects the experience that you have here studying, you know, history or the language or literature to something concrete and real.
Dublin's a really interesting and enjoyable experience for students. It's right in the middle of summer. There's a lot going on in the city in terms of cultural events. So students actually live on campus and study, take their classes on campus in Trinity.
One of the things that sets our summer study abroad program apart is the extent to which we get our students outside of Dublin.
Every single place that you go to in Ireland, every county has a wildly different, you know, culture or community than the county next door. We got to go see the west of Ireland. We went to Inishbofin, which is a tiny island about a 45-minute ferry ride off the coast of Galway. We went to Northern Ireland as well, which was really, really cool.
One of the most impressive places for me, I think, was Tory Island, because it is a very remote place that a lot of Irish people don't even go to and are very surprised when you tell them that you've been there. And we got to meet the king of Tory Island, who gave us a tour and was an incredibly interesting man. And it was just a really cool experience to have that, where most Irish people even would be surprised to hear that you've done this.
In addition to planned trips, students also have free time where we allow them to travel all over Ireland, and they've gone to extraordinary places on their own. Our students have really come away from that experience of studying in Ireland with an incredibly positive view of the country and of the program that's brought them there.
It is by far one of the best things I've ever done, and if I could go back and do it again, I'd do it every single summer.
The majority of our courses are offered between 6 and 9 in the evening here at Ireland House, and that enables people who are working full-time to pursue the degree by doing one or two courses a semester. It's a challenge to be a graduate student today, there's no doubt about that. We're now actually in a position to give financial support, up to 50% of financial aid, to students pursuing the program either full-time or part-time. And we're really excited about that, because we think people with the passion deserve that kind of support.
We're coming to the end of the program for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next time at 9 a.m. Saturday on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and our phone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radio hour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Sandley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.